Hey guys, welcome to our second to last podcast on Genesis. So we left off in Genesis 34. And if you recall, Genesis 34 was the rape of Dinah and the destruction of Shechem. And so in the 35th chapter, God's going to tell Jacob and the whole house of Israel to get out. We've got to get out and we're going to head south. And I put a map in the slides where it's an interesting map because you can see it's south facing. So, and it's kind of like one of these 3D maps. And so you can kind of see on the right hand side that they're in Shechem and they're going to go south. And you'll see on the right hand side of the map that they're going to go to Bethel. And that's really close to Jerusalem. Later, Rachel's going to die and she'll be buried right there in Bethlehem. And you'll see in the center of the map is the Jordan River Valley. And it's just kind of a cool map. So this is kind of an introduction here that this is the story of Jacob. It's going to be the things that happen in his family and with his kids. And you'll see also what happens with the jealousy and the tension that happens with the brothers as they get kind of frustrated with Joseph. And so verse 3 of the 35th chapter says, "Let us arise and go to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God." And so Jacob decides, hey, we're going to leave. We're going to leave Shechem here, and we're going to go south to Bethel. And Bethel is El and Beth, house of God, Beit El. We're going to go to this southern place where we've seen God. And they gave unto Jacob all their strange gods. In the beginning of Genesis 35, he says, hey, gather up these images, these false gods. And so they give up their earrings, and Jacob hid them under an oak, which was in Shechem. And so they journey. And it says in verse 5 that their enemies don't pursue them. And then they come to this place called Luz or Bethel. And that's where they build an altar. Now, a couple of thoughts. We see a lot of moving around in the Genesis narrative. People are always having to move. You've got Abraham being commanded to move. And you've got in this narrative, Jacob. And one of the things I like about this and a really good devotional reading of this text is this idea that God is going to move his people. He's going to scatter them. And this is riddled with planting imagery. God's going to move his people. And those that listen, those that are obedient, go where God moves them to go. And they grow where they're planted. And so this is kind of like in the narrative in John where Jesus says, I am the vine or you are the branches. And you couldn't grow without me. You plugged into me, the vine, and you'll grow. And it's a constant invitation to us to go ahead and when we're moved by the Spirit, to go where we're told to go. And sometimes there's multiple places you can go. Sometimes it's not one thing. I had a friend once that said, you know, I prayed and prayed and prayed if I should move to this area. And I felt a good feeling about it. I felt the Spirit say that would be acceptable. But then I prayed to take a different job and move to a different location. And I had the same feeling. And so I think sometimes that's the answer. I think sometimes they're both good. Sometimes you'll have a really strong spiritual impression to go and to go to a certain place. And so just be aware of those. And I think these kind of things are happening in Genesis where God tells them to move. And I think what we're trying to do is we're pushing the house of Israel south. And part of it is because of the famine that's going to come up, right? It's interesting how you can see the providence of God. There's going to be a famine and the whole house of Israel is going to perish if it weren't for Joseph, who's going to be in Egypt, where the Nile River is just this constant source of nourishment and the land produces. And if Joseph's not there, we don't save him. And so I think one of the things Moses or the author of Genesis, whoever wrote it, is trying to show us is that even in the middle of the bad things, there's some good stuff happening here. And God is in charge. God is in the background of all these things. And he's in the background of our lives. So I really like that. I have another map where you can see it's kind of a bigger map where you can see Padamaram up in the north where Turkey is. And then he comes down to Peniel and then to Shechem and then to Bethel. So just to kind of get an idea, these guys are moving. They're going places. And so that in essence is the beginning of Genesis 35. So he builds an altar. And then we get the narrative where his name is changed. Now, you probably remember from our previous podcast that Israel or Jacob's name was changed to Israel back in Genesis 32, 28 through 30. And that account is from the north. That account of his name being changed to Israel is from E or the north. But this account, that we read in Genesis 35:10. Actually, these verses 9 through 16 are from a priestly author, which we think the priestly author was the textual tradition that was the last to be inserted into the Old Testament. But regardless of how you look at it, this is a doublet in the narrative. And once again, a doublet is where it's a story told twice. And so God appears to him in verse 9. It says, again. So in this narrative, it's not someone wrestling Jacob, but it's actually God. And so a lot of times in Christianity, what we do is we just conflate these two narratives and we say, hey, it was God wrestling with him. But then if you remember from our last podcast, Joseph Fielding Smith says, no, this is not the same story. Certainly, nobody can beat God in a wrestling match. You can't suit up, as it were, and pin God and hold him down to score 3 points or what have you. I don't know the rules in wrestling and how they score it, but you know my point. Now, I never did wrestle. But here, his name is changed, and it says in verse 10, God said, thy name is Jacob, thy name shall not be called anymore Jacob, but Yisrael, or Israel. That shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And God said, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. That's a priestly petition. That's a priestly command, to be fruitful and multiply. And so what's going to happen? A nation and company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I'm going to give to you. So we get the land promise again, and we get the promise of posterity. But notice, no promise of priesthood. That's going to be in the Abraham account that Joseph Smith gives to us. And once again, those three P's, priesthood, posterity, and property, if you take them to their infinite degree, if you have infinite priesthood and infinite property and infinite posterity, you are like Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. And so the Abrahamic covenant is an invitation to us as His children to become like Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, to partake of that power. And so when we get sealed in the temple, those promises are extended to us. And so here they are right here in Genesis 35. And it gets sad because after this, Rachel has hard labor, it says in verse 16, and she dies in verse 18. The name of the child is Benjamin, or son of the right hand. She calls his name Ben-Oni, and if you look in the footnote, it's son of my sorrow or distress. Ben is son of the right hand. And Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And so I put in the slides, you can see the traditional location of Rachel's tomb, and you can see it there, and you can actually go visit it today. It's in the West Bank, it's in occupied territory, but you can get a tour there and go see Rachel's tomb. And according to Wikipedia, it's the third most holy site in Judaism. And so she dies, and it is sad because if you think about it, from Rachel comes the birthright. From her comes Joseph. She was the wife that Jacob just loves. And so this is, you can see tragedy woven in here. There probably should be a whole narrative of Jacob bewailing the loss of his wife and the sadness of Jacob. We don't have so much of this, but I think that when we get the full Old Testament narrative, we're going to see the pain that he goes through. And the promises and the love that he has for her is going to be extended to Joseph. So we get a double whammy when Joseph is taken from him. And you can just sense Father Jacob's depression here, how difficult this is going to be for him. But like I said, we don't have it. We just have this story where she dies, and then you get right to this tragic verse in verse 22. Verse 22 is another one of these troubling verses. So Genesis 35, 22 says that Reuben went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Bilhah is the handmaiden of Rachel, and Reuben is the firstborn son of Leah. And so just a thought, I think we're constructing a narrative where we can see that it's kind of like knocking down pins if you're a bowler. You set up the pins of all the sons who have the potential to be a birthright son prior to Joseph or in front of him, and they just get knocked down. So if you remember, Simeon and Levi were ruled out in the 34th chapter of Genesis, and in the 35th chapter, Reuben is going to be ruled out because he sleeps with his father's wife. And that is one of the things that Leviticus 18 says, that's a no-no, you don't do that. And so he does it, and it doesn't really say anything else. It just says that he does it, and then it says that Israel heard. And then we get this shift. Now, the sons of Jacob were 12, and then they just go boom, 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 boom. They start listing them out. And then it talks about how he visits Isaac. And then in the 28th verse, it says Isaac was 180 years old. And in scholarship, they say, well, clearly that's not written by the Yahwist, because the Yahwist says you can only live to be 120, if you remember from our previous podcast. Well, here Isaac's 180, so that's a different author. That's P, one of the last strain of the Old Testament. And then it says, Isaac gave up the ghost, so he dies. And then the 36th chapter is all this genealogy about Edom. So it's interesting. In scholarship, they look at this and they say there's breaks in the narrative. So we've got this break, right, where Reuben sleeps with his father's wife. And then we get this stuff about Jacob and his family. And then we get this stuff about him visiting Isaac. And then, boom, we get to this family of Esau. So there's like, you can just see, it's glaring, right, these seams in the text. But what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about Reuben, because anciently they had all kinds of notions about what this meant and why this happened and who's to blame. And I think sometimes these questions are worth, you know, exploring a little bit. Not that you have to believe any of this stuff, but it's good to see that the Jews anciently, they wrestled with this stuff. They didn't know, they clearly don't have all the answers in canonized scripture. And so subsequent tradition tried to fill in the gaps, the stuff that's missing. You know, it's clear that there's editing taking place and we're missing this whole thing. But can you imagine if you were Moses, or if you're a Mormon and you're writing the Book of Mormon and you're like, oh yeah, by the way, this tragic thing happened. The supposed birthright son slept with his father's wife and then it just went to something else. You know, Mormon would say something like, and thus we see ... or this is how it happened, or, you know, this is the angel that appeared to him and said, knock it off, or this is how it was discovered. And in the Bible right here, it's just gone. And so, you know, we don't have it. It's like, it's a missing thing. And so we get a couple of documents that come to us, and these are called pseudepigraphal, or I like to call them extra biblical literature. I think pseudepigrapha has kind of a negative tone to it. Pseudo meaning false. So falsely attributed is generally how pseudepigrapha is looked at. I like to say, well, this is extra biblical literature. Like I said, I don't know if this is true. I certainly, you know, wasn't there, but I know that this is really old. And a couple of the things we're going to quote from is going to be a document called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And we don't know exactly when these traditions became solidified, but we think probably this document is around the second century CE. So, you know, 200 AD, 150 AD, somewhere around there after Jesus. Some people say that the Christians got their hands on it and put, you know, Christian things into it. But nevertheless, in this Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, and I give you the links in the slides, each one of these 12 guys, these 12 sons of Judah, gets to give a speech and they get to talk about things and they give advice and these kinds of things, and you can read it. I'm going to cite the Testament of Reuben, who's one of the 12. And then another text that we've talked about before, that's the Book of Jubilees, and that's kind of like the alternate version of Genesis that didn't make it in the Bible. And it's really tough to date. Scholars wrap their heads around this and say, you know, what date do we give this? A lot of scholars are going to say, hey, it's probably right around the Maccabean Revolt, right around 165 BC. And so those are the two documents. They're super old, you know, a couple thousand years old. And what they do is they, like I said, they try to fill in the gaps about what's going on with Reuben. And so I put this in the slide. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but essentially in the Testament of Reuben, he kind of tries to explain himself. And this is what he says. He talks about how God gave him a plague for 7 months. And then he says, and had not my father Jacob prayed for me to the Lord would have destroyed me. Reuben says, after this, I repented with set purpose of my soul for 7 years before the Lord, and wine and strong drink I drank not, and flesh entered not into my mouth. So he's going totally vegetarian here. And I ate no pleasant food. I can relate. I kind of like meat. Give me some chicken, fried chicken. But I mourned over my sin, for it was great, such as had not been in Israel. Pay no heed, he says, to the face of a woman, nor associate with another man's wife, nor meddle with the affairs of womankind. For had I not seen Bilhah bathing in a covered place, I had not fallen into this great iniquity. For my mind, taking in the thought of the woman's nakedness, suffered me not to sleep until I had wrought the abominable thing. For while Jacob our father was gone to Isaac his father, when we were near Ephrath in Bethlehem, Bilhah came drunk and was asleep, uncovered in her chamber. Having therefore gone in and beheld nakedness, I wrought the impiety without her perceiving it. So in the testament of Reuben, Reuben takes total responsibility and Bilhah is exonerated. She's not guilty. And he basically says, hey, it's all on me. I was the bad guy. It's not Bilhah. Please don't shame her. And so it's interesting how it's trying to fill in the gaps in this and put blame somewhere. And then later it says, yet my father comforted me much and prayed for me unto the Lord that the anger of the Lord might not pass from me, even as the Lord showed. And thenceforth until now, I have been on my guard and sinned not. So there's a couple really hopeful things in here that I think we can take out of the testament of Reuben. And one of them is Jacob in this document forgives Reuben. Now, we don't read necessarily that in Genesis 35, but I like that. I like that notion that when your spouse goes astray, that you forgive. I have a friend who one time I asked him this question. He served in a leadership position where he's had to deal with a lot of members of the church and infidelities over the time, over the period of his service. He was in a stake presidency, a double duty. I think he did 14 years in multiple stake presidencies, and just a good friend of mine and just the salt of the earth. And I asked him one time, I said, you know, don't give me details, but tell me, how do people react to this? Like when a spouse goes astray, you know, what's your experience been? And he got really serious and he just looked at me and he said, Mike, without exception, there's so much forgiveness. He says, whether it's the wife who does it or the husband, he says, I'm just so impressed with the Latter-day Saints and their forgiveness and their willingness to work it through. And I thought, wow, that's a gift of the Spirit. And so I want to extend to you that feeling, that notion. It's not in the text, but it's in extra-biblical literature. And I can't teach this stuff with Reuben without getting into as the weeds, as it were, or going down some of these dirt roads. I also like at the end of this that we just read, where Reuben says, you know what, since that time, I've been on my guard and I've sinned not. And I also think that's a really good invitation to us as Latter-day Saints to think about chastity and to think about what measures do you put in place to guard so that these things don't happen. I think that, you know, we're only 35 chapters in Genesis, but how many times have we seen infidelity of some sort take place? And it's never presented in a good light by the authors. They never, you know, Moses or whoever wrote Genesis is never saying, hey, this is a good idea. It's always showing you the consequences and the sadness that's caused by this. And I'm a big fan of this idea that chastity really is about family and children. When the father and mother protect that and they honor each other and they love each other, then the children are protected. And so anyway, I like that. The book of Jubilees is another text. We talked about this earlier, but just to recap, probably about the Maccabean revolt is when it was textualized, right around 160 BC. But in this, it says that Reuben saw Bilhah bathing in a secret place and he loved her. And then it says that he lay with her and she awoke, and behold, Reuben, who was lying with her in the bed, when she uncovered the border of her covering, and she seized him and cried out. And she was ashamed, and she released her hand from him, and he fled. So in the book of Jubilees, it's laying the blame once again on Reuben, and she's crying out. And she's the one that's saying, hey, this is wrong. In the book of Jubilees, she does come to Jacob and tell him what happened. And it talks about Jacob being exceedingly wroth with Reuben. And so, once again, we're filling in gaps of this narrative. So that's an important thing that both these texts tackle. And this is how, essentially, Reuben loses the birthright. So to recap, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, the oldest three sons of Leah, are now ousted from birthright candidacy. So that's where we are. The 36th chapter of Genesis is one of those that typically in a Sunday school class gets skipped over because it's the generations of Esau. And since this is a lineage history and the lineage of Jacob is what matters according to the way the Bible is constructed, Edom is just kind of off to the side, kind of like Ishmael. But in this section, we have an entire chapter dedicated to the descendants of Esau. And a lot of times in scholarship, this is called the Edomite king list. The Edomites live to the south, and they were their own nation. And in modern scholarship, they've found that, hey, this is another example of the documentary hypothesis, because the Edomite kings in this king list all live way after Moses' time. So certainly Moses could not have written Genesis 36 because he would have been dead before these kings lived. And so was this an editorial insertion that was later? And I would say, well, yeah, that's probably how the best way to read it. The first 30 verses are P, we think, and that's like the latest stuff added to the Bible, or the last stuff added to the Bible. And they're called dukes in the King James Version. Not to get too nerdy, but I am going to geek out on this for a minute. If you read verses 2-5, the wives of Esau don't actually match up to the wives of Esau. So if you read Genesis 26:34, it says that, you know, he marries Judith. And if you read Genesis 28:9, it says that he marries Mahalath. And those are not the names of the wives here. And so the simple answer in scholarship is that we're just talking about a couple different narrative strains. But it's these kinds of careful readings of the text that if you, the reader, read it carefully, you can see, oh, wow, these wives don't match up. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, big picture, but just know that this is happening. So these are the Edomites. And once again, notice verse 8, chapter 36, it says that Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, and Esau is Edom. Remember, Seir is another way of saying hairy. So the Edomites are hairy. So they're punning on all this stuff. And so we have it again in verse 9. They dwell, you know, in Mount Seir. We have it again in 20 and 21. And there's all this list of this genealogical information associated with Edom. One of the questions people ask is, you know, why is this in the Bible and who put it there? And one of the things that we think is going on in scholarship, they think what happened is during David's administration as the king of Israel, he conquers the Edomites. And so we think that that's when the Edomite king list gets put in by scribes or people that work in or around the temple or around royalty. Perhaps that happened when, like I said, when David was the one who conquered and incorporated Edom into the Israelite empire. This could represent the hope that the two brothers, Israel and Edom, would indeed be reconciled into one nation. Because you remember, Edom and Israel both come from Jacob. Certainly the long list of names, some of which were familiar Israelite names, stresses this idea that the Edomites were like the cousins of these guys, that the Edomites and Israel were close cousins. That Esau becomes a nation recalls the promise to Rebekah that she would be the mother of two nations. If you remember that promise, remember Rebekah's so close to the Spirit, and she has that revelation that she'd be the mother of two nations. Well, from her two sons, Jacob and Esau, we get Israel and the Edomites, the kingdom of Edom. That Edom became part of the Davidic Empire, even though it was older and they had kings before Israel. This shows us that the older did serve the younger. If you remember Genesis 25:23, that prophecy. And so whenever this king list was written, like we don't know, it does reinforce the message that the promise was fulfilled, even its less important aspects concerning other nations. Later history is going to illustrate the divisions between Jacob and Esau rather than their reconciliations. So they're reconciled and the Edomites are conquered by Israel. But throughout the biblical narrative, there's this stress that these guys don't like each other. They have like fierce wars. It fed fire of mutual hatred. If you read 2 Samuel 8, 13 and 14, or 1 Kings 11, 15 through 16, or 2 Kings 14, 7, these texts show readers that there was warfare with these guys, and it did culminate in some real bitter prayers. One of the most powerful prayers in the Bible is Psalm 137, 7 through 9. I remember reading this when I went to the Western Wall. There's a plaque there, and Psalm 137 is quoted, and it's this strong prayer to God, and there's a lot of indignation against Edom in the Bible. And so, wow. It's strong stuff. Even at the end of the Old Testament, if you read Malachi's phrase where he says, I have loved Jacob, but Esau have I hated, in Malachi 1, 2 through 3. So it's very tough. Like the Bible has some really interesting and faith-promoting ideas of reconciliation, but it also leaves readers with a sense of, wow, these guys did not like each other. And what I love about the Book of Mormon is it also shows these strong disagreements. But if you're going through the Come Follow Me right now, you also see the flip side to this, where the sons of Mosiah and Alma, even though these guys are bitter enemies and they want to kill us, their message is, no, God loves these guys. These guys are children of God. And the field is ripe already to harvest, and how awesome the Lord is. And so I really like to read, whenever I read these tensions with the Edomites and the hatred, I love to go to the Book of Alma. And I love to read the story of the sons of Mosiah and some of those narratives there. For example, Ammon's narrative in the 26th chapter of the Book of Mormon, or the 26th chapter of the Book of Alma, where he says, verse 5, the field was ripe, and blessed are ye, for ye did thrust in the sickle and reap with your might. All the day long did you labor, and behold the number of your sheaves, and they shall be gathered into the garners. He's so excited. Aaron kind of rebukes him, and he's like, in verse 10, he's like, hey, bro, I think you're bragging. And Ammon's like, no, I do not boast in my own strength or in my wisdom, but behold, my joy is full. Yea, my heart is brim with joy, and I will rejoice in my God. And then he says, I know that I am nothing. But then in verse 13, he says, many thousands of our brethren has he loosed from the pains of hell. And they were encircled with darkness, he says, but behold, he has brought them into his everlasting light. That's Alma 36:15. And I just love this. And I love this because I think Alma 26 is a commentary on some of these tensions in the Bible that we just never really get resolved, at least in the Old Testament. I think these tensions are resolved in Jesus. When we read the New Testament, especially when we're introduced to the character of Saul, who becomes Paul, we're introduced to this idea that these outsiders are just as important to God as the insiders. And so Paul flips it on its lid. But if all you have is the Old Testament and that's all you're reading, boy, there sure are these tensions that really are never fully resolved, in my opinion, until we get to Paul and his experiences in the New Testament. And so that's why I love, another reason why I love Alma 26 and some of those chapters there. Okay, Genesis 37. Genesis 37 is the betrayal of Joseph, the brothers of Joseph. So once Rachel's dead, the brothers, when Joseph hits a certain age, they decide to betray him and he's going to be sold into slavery. And it's really two stories that are woven together. And before we get into the details and the weeds, and I totally nerd out on it, some big picture stuff. I think this is a story about jealousy. It's also a story about how we parent. I think that maybe this doesn't happen if maybe all the brothers feel equally loved. Now, I don't know. I wasn't there. But I think this is another way to look at this. And I really like Alma 29. And if you remember, oh, that I were an angel, everyone's aware of that verse. But there's an interesting couple of phrases in the 29th chapter of Alma that really relate to Genesis 37. So look at verse 3. Of Alma 29. He says, after he says, oh, that I were an angel, he says, I ought to be content with the things which the Lord hath allotted unto me. And I think that's a really important message. I think that we live in a world where we're just never content. If you think about it, millions of dollars are spent by advertising agencies to make you not content with your station in life. I also think that a lot of this is targeted towards us with social media. People are posting pictures of their vacations. I have a good friend who worked out really hard and got six-pack abs, and he went to a professional photographer and has these amazing pictures of his abs. And I gotta be honest, I'm so jealous, man. Who doesn't want a six-pack? I mean, wow. And I can't wait till we go back to church and I high-five him and say, bro, you are my idol. But it did kind of fired me up. Like, I want to, not in a bad way, but it kind of made me want to work out harder. I'm like, I want to be like this guy, but am I content, right? Am I content with where I am? And I don't know how you feel about this or if this has really struck you, but I remember one time somebody that I knew in college, I found out that they were super duper successful as far as the world goes. And I Googled them and I read all these, they were doing all these amazing things. And I had this thought that occurred to me. And the thought was, Mike, what have you done with your life? You're a total loser. And I remember thinking that it was visceral. I could feel it. And I think Alma 29 verse 3 is that invitation to not be that way, to just, we ought to be content with the things that the Lord has allotted unto us, with the path that he's put us on. Verse 4, I ought not to harrow up in my desires the firm decree of a just God, for I know that he grants unto men according to their desire, whether it be unto death or unto life. So there's a lot there. But just know that that's one of the messages of Alma 29. But then there's later in Alma 29, it says this in verse 14, I do not joy in my own success alone, but my joy is more full because of the success of my brethren who have been up to the land of Nephi. Now, verse 14 is Alma talking about the success of the sons of Mosiah. Now, they don't all have tons of success, but if you remember, Ammon has a ton. But Alma, there were times when maybe it didn't work out so well. For example, with the Zoramites. And how about some of the people that they did see converted that were killed? Now, I don't know the numbers, right? We don't know the numbers of who had the most baptisms, as it were, on a mission. But I think if you served in a mission where maybe you didn't have high volume, lots of people baptized, sometimes one of the things that you might say to yourself is, well, did it count? Or did the Lord accept my sacrifice? And Alma says this. He says, I'm so stoked. I have so much joy for the success of my brethren. And I think when we're really content with the road the Lord has put us on, we can have full joy for the people around us that are having success, and even if it seems like they're having more success than us. And then he says in verse 16, when I think of the success of these, my brethren, my soul is carried away, even to the separation of it from my body, as it were, so great is my joy. He's just so happy that other people have success. And I thought a lot about that recently, because I don't think that the brothers, the sons of Jacob, as it were, are the embodiment of that spirit. I don't think that they're showing us that kind of characteristic. They're really jealous of Joseph. At least that's one reading of Genesis 37. And so this is really tough, because I think it's showing us who we are. And can we be content with where we are? And can we be grateful when other people have success? And so I would just invite you to think about that and to ponder that. I also see this as foreshadowing of Jesus. If you notice some of the ideas that are repeated by the gospel authors, in, like I said, there's two accounts in Genesis 37, but in one of the accounts, it's Judah who says, hey, let's sell him. And they sell him for 20 pieces of silver. We read in verse 26, Judah said, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. For he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers heeded him. And they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver and took Joseph to Egypt. And so that's one image, is Judah selling him and they betray him and they turn him over. And if you think about how the gospel authors take this with Judas selling out Jesus, not for 20 pieces, but for 30 pieces. In the other narrative, in the Elohim narrative from the north, Joseph is put in a pit and he's not sold. He's put into a pit and the pit was empty. And then later, the Midianites pull him out. And then Reuben goes to the pit. It's Reuben's idea from the northern account. He goes to the pit and he rends his clothes and he returns to his brothers in verse 30. And he's like, where's Joseph? He's gone. And so it's a fascinating thing, because in the northern account, it's not the Ishmaelites, but it's the Midianites that take him in verse 36 and sell him to Egypt. But the type is still there. He goes into the pit and they don't know where he is and he's gone. Well, later, Joseph's going to save his whole family. And so the gospel writers are very aware of Genesis. And I think what one of the things they're trying to do is show us that the Old Testament has Jesus in it, but we have to kind of relax our eyes a little bit and see the types and the shadows that point us to Jesus Christ. So I like reading Genesis 37 as a type of Christ, and Joseph as a type of the Redeemer. And so in these show notes, I'm going to share a slide or a handout that you can use to see how he really is a type of Christ. And it's quite the list. But you think about Genesis 37:1, it says that his father was a stranger in the land. And we read that in Luke 2. Both are shepherds, Genesis 37:2. Joseph is the mediator between the father and the other children. Both are most beloved sons. That's Genesis 37, verse 3. They also, both the sons have robes of power, which is very much associated with the temple. John, in the Gospel of John, is the only one to tell us this, that Jesus had a robe without seam. And a robe without seam was a message that John's trying to send. That was the robe of the great high priest. And so to John, Jesus is the great high priest. And to the author of Genesis 37, clearly this robe has some kind of significance to the brothers, such that they want to kill him, such that they want to take it away. And so that's how it kind of begins. Now, I don't think this is a coat of many colors. And there's a lot of ink spilled on this, but I'm just going to just quote the footnote here in Genesis 37, 3C. The Septuagint word indicates many colors, but the Hebrew term simply indicates a long coat with sleeves. But whatever it was, this has significance to the brothers, and it's a sign of who Joseph is. And so they're going to be jealous, and they're going to do this to him. I'm going to nerd out just for a minute on the couple of strands of the text here briefly. So there's two accounts, and I'm going to post a link. You can read it. It's all color-coded, and you can read it. But essentially, we have a northern text, which is going to be blue, and we have a southern text, which is J, and it's a different color, and I'm colorblind, so I don't know what color it is, but you can clearly see it. And in this story, from the north, it's Reuben who says, hey, let's not kill him. So I'm just going to read a couple of verses. Verses 12 to the end of verse 18 is the northern text. And so it starts out and it says, his brothers went to pasture near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, are your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I'll send you to him. And he said, here I am. And he said, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word again. So he sent him from the valley, and he came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering the fields. And the man said, what are you seeking? And he said, I'm seeking my brothers. And he said, tell me, I pray you, where they are pasturing. The man said, they've gone away, for I have heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them at Dothan. And he saw them afar off. Before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And then it breaks. Go to verse 21. When Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, let us not take his life. Reuben said, shed no blood. Cast him in the pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So in the 22nd verse, Reuben's the good guy. Remember, this is a northern text. Reuben's from the north. And his goal is to not kill Joseph, but to restore him to his brother. So in verse 24 is where it picks up. They took him and cast him in the pit. The pit was empty and there was no water in it. Verse 25, they sat down to eat. That's the end of that verse right there. That's the end of the blue text. Verse 28, then Midianite traders passed by and they drew Joseph up and they lifted him out of the pit. Verse 29, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw Joseph wasn't in it, he rent his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, the lad is gone. Where shall I go? And then it skips all the way to verse 36 and says, meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So from the northern perspective, there was no intent to kill him. And he was taken by the Midianites. And it's this sad story. Now, that's not the way it reads from the southern perspective. From the J account, we have Joseph being 17 years old. This is verse 3. He is, you know, he comes and they report to his fathers, and we read about the long coat with sleeves. And then verse 5, verses 5 to 11 is the southern account. Joseph had a dream and he tells it to his brothers and they hate him. And he said to them, hear this dream which I have dreamed. And he tells them all about the dream of the sheaves and how they bowed down to him. And then in verse 9, it says, behold, I dreamed another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. But when he told this to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. And so from the southern perspective, Joseph is kind of portrayed as a brat, kind of a braggart. So it picks up again in the verse in verse 19, where it says, "They said one to another, 'Here comes this dreamer. Come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, that we shall say that a wild beast devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams.'" And so they conspire and say, "Let's throw him in a pit." Go to verse 23, where it picks up again. "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore." Skip to verse 25. "And looking up, they saw a caravan, not of Midianites this time, but of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing gum and balm and myrrh on their way to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers," now remember, this is a southern text, so Judah is the hero. "Judah says to his brothers, 'What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother, our own flesh.' And his brothers heeded him." And then skip to 28, the middle of the verse. "They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt." And then it skips to verse 31, and 31 to the end of 35 is the end. That's where they bring the garments, and they say he's dead because they kill the goat, and they disguise it, and they hide what happens, and the father weeps. And so those are the two narratives, and I will link it so you can see in the notes here. You can see it for yourself, and you can see how it's described and how it's viewed. And here's what we think's happening. Both the northern and the southern text come from their prophetic traditions. Remember, the house of Israel is unified under David, but it splits after Solomon dies in 921. And from 921 BC to 721 BC, the house of Israel, we have the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and they kind of don't like each other. But in 721 BC, an interesting thing happens. You see, Assyria comes from the north, and they take Israel and scatter them. They don't scatter Judah. Well, what we think happens is in 721, prophets, priests, scribes, the elite, the literate, they come south with their texts, and these northern texts and these southern texts are stitched together. They're put together by an editor or scribes or prophets or what have you, and both stories from tradition are put together, and in scholarship they call this JE, and they think these two strains are put together right around 700 BC, about 100 years before Nephi. And so when Nephi takes the brass plates, he clearly has a Bible that's different than what you and I have, because he's got stuff in there that gets edited after Nephi, and probably was even in the editorial process under Josiah's reign. I have a whole podcast on that if you're interested that I can link for you if you want to hear it. And so I'll put that in the notes as well so that you can have access to that. But that's just a little brief introduction to Genesis 37. It's a big deal. But if you don't want to nerd out, if the last 5 minutes of me nerding out on the text, it was just kind of lame, then just know this. I see this as a story of Jesus. I see him going into the pit, and he's going to redeem his family, and he's going to do great things. And even in the midst of these horrible things happening to him by his brothers, we're going to see the hand of God. And that's going to be in our next podcast. So before we leave Genesis 37, I just want to recap some of the ways that Joseph of Egypt is a type of Christ. And so once again, their father was a stranger in a strange land. Genesis 37:1, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger. Luke 2:4 says this, Joseph went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was the house and lineage of David. Luke presents Joseph as someone not from Judea. Judea is in the south and Galilee is in the north. And so two distinct areas. Both were shepherds. Both Joseph and the Savior, John 10:11 talks about Jesus being the good shepherd. Now, we know he's a carpenter, but he's using those symbols. John's creating a text that shows you Jesus as a shepherd. Both were a mediator between the father and the children. If you look in Genesis 37:2, where he's to give messages to the brothers, and so the father sends him out. Both were beloved sons. Both had robes of power, as we've stated. Both were hated by their peers. Both were prophets, seers, and revelators. Eventually, all worship these individuals. In Genesis 37:7, we read that Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves stood around about and made obeisance to my sheaf. This is where Joseph gives them the dream that he has, where the brothers will bow down to him. Now, that dream is reported to us from the southern text, where they want to portray Joseph as kind of a bad guy or maybe a braggart. Nevertheless, that dream comes true in the total package, the total narrative. He will rule over the other children, Genesis 37:8. You can cross-reference that with Helaman 12:6, where Helaman 12:6 just says that he should rule and reign over them. Notwithstanding his great goodness, they set it not as counsels, and they would not that he should be their guide. In so many cases, Genesis 37 points us to types of Christ. They both leave the presence of their father. People want to kill him. They're betrayed. They conspire and they unite against him. As in Genesis 37, they're both, Jesus and Joseph, stripped of their robes, betrayed by their brother. We have Judas or Judah, which Judah and Judas are essentially the same name. Just, you know, we're dealing with different texts. Both Judah and Judas profit, one sold for 20 and one sold for 30 pieces of silver. Both of these individuals do end up going down to Egypt. Jesus in his youth, Joseph as a slave. The senior brother or the senior apostle goes down into the pit. We have Reuben or we have Peter going into this empty pit. Their garments were parted. Their garments were red with blood. This is all Genesis 37:31. The father suffers from their death, Genesis 37, verse 35. So Genesis 37 is just so full of imagery about Jesus that on the surface may not be very plain, but if we just read it, and if you read Genesis 37 and you just look at it through the lens of, okay, do I see Jesus in here? I think the answer is certainly, especially if you're looking carefully. But, you know, one or two of these, just one or two of these instances would be maybe a chance meeting with a symbol of Jesus. But when you take it in its total package, in its totality, and you just keep adding these up and stacking them on top of each other, you can see, in my opinion, that the author of Genesis 37 is foreshadowing Jesus. Now, those that are purely into scholarship and they don't have any faith, they would say that the gospel writers are writing Jesus into this using Genesis 37 as like a paradigm or a pattern. But I would say it's probably a little bit of both, that the author of Genesis is inspired and he's telling us this story, and also that the gospel writers recognize how Jesus is the fulfillment of these types. And so they're making sure that they put these in their narrative as well so that we can see it. And so in other words, both of these events happened and there are so many points of connection that it can't be by chance. Anyway, so that's Genesis 37. Great stuff. I just didn't want to leave Genesis 37 without at least examining some of those things. Genesis 38. Well, this one is really interesting and this is a tough chapter. Genesis 38 is the story of Judah and Tamar. Tamar is a woman, and Judah is the son of Jacob and Leah. And as you remember, we have already negated as possible birthright sons Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. Genesis 38 is our chance now to, we're going to denigrate Judah. We're going to show you that Judah is not a birthright son. This whole chapter of Genesis 38 is in what's called a chiastic structure. It begins and ends the same with its central point in the middle. The center of this is going to be Tamar exercising her rights. She's going to be an individual that acts and is not acted upon in verses 12 through 19, the center of this narrative. So the beginning of it, verses 1 through 5, is Judah starts a family. And the beginning and the ending parallel each other. The ending of it is verse 27 through 30, where Judah's family is continued through Tamar. Anyway, I'll post a picture of this so you can kind of see it. But after Judah starts his family in verses 6 through 10, the sons of Judah are dying because of their wickedness. And then Judah sends Tamar back home. Tamar is this woman that is married to the sons of Judah that keep dying. And at one point, she says, hey, I want to be married to your next son. That was the the Levirate marriage rule, right? If the brother dies, then the woman gets to marry the next brother. And the reason why is she's not destitute. So she has a place and she's taken care of. And Judah doesn't take care of her. He just tells his daughter-in-law, hey, you go back home. So verses 12 through 19 is where she, through cunning craftiness, exercises her rights so that she's protected. And then in the next part, so that's the middle of it, then the next part, verses 20 through 23, Judah sends his friend Hira to go and inquire about this experience that we're going to talk about in 12 through 19. And then in verses 24 through 26, Judah condemns Tamar to death, but she proves to be righteous. And that kind of parallels the sons of Judah dying because of their wickedness. And then finally, Judah's family is continued through Tamar. So that's structurally what's happening in the text. And it's easier to see than in a podcast, but just know that this is a very tightly constructed narrative to teach a specific thing, several things. And I think the first reading of it, we can kind of be disgusted and we can kind of be horrified. But I'm okay with modern readers being bothered by this story. But there's other ways to view it as well. So we're going to get into those. So let's look at this. We've got Judah and he has a child, and it says there was a certain daughter, a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and he went unto her. So Judah is already marrying outside of the covenant in verse 2. And she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. She conceived again and had Onan. And she conceived and had another son, and he was Chezib. And then Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And Er dies, and so Tamar is now a widow. So then he has another son named Onan, and this son gets married to her, and he dies. Verse 9 and 10 talks about that. And then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at my father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown. And then verse 12, in process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to the sheep shearers to Timnath, he and his friend Hira. So the author of the text is trying to make it clear to you that Judah is now a single man. His wife is dead. His two sons are dead. He has one son left, and he hasn't married her to Tamar. And Tamar is just kind of waiting. And so it says in verse 13 that it was told Tamar, saying, behold, thy father-in-law goeth to Timnath to shear his sheep. So she's in a state of destitution. She doesn't have anybody to take care of her. And so essentially in verses 14 through 19, she dresses up like a prostitute, by the way. And she's veiled. And in verse 15, it says, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot. And so he goes up to her and he tries to negotiate, you know, what's the price? How much will it cost? And he eventually says in verse 17, I'll give you a kid from my flock. And then she says, well, you don't have a kid. You don't have anything with you. And she's like, what do I have as collateral? In verse 18, he says, the signet and bracelets that I have. And so he gives her these items as collateral. And then it says in the end of verse 18, he gave it to her and came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And so the author wants you to know that verse 18, they've consummated this relationship. So the next day, he goes his way, and he sends his friend Hira to go and give a kid to her, but he just can't find her. He goes and he looks and he just keeps trying and he's searching. And he finally comes to Judah and he's like, listen, I can't find this woman, you know, this woman you're talking about. She's not there. And Judah kind of drops it. He kind of forgets about the experience. And then later in the text, we find that, you know, through a period of time, it says in verse 24, about 3 months later, that it was told Judah, this is verse 24, Tamar, thy daughter, is been playing the harlot, and she's with child. And Judah gets all indignant, and he's like, well, she's got to die. Let her be burnt, the end of verse 24. He's pretty fired up. Now, I'm personally not a fan of burning up people that commit adultery, personally. But just so you're aware, Leviticus 21:9, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by playing the whore, she profaneth her father, she shall be burnt with fire. So right out of there in Leviticus, in the priestly law, we've got this text that says, hey, if you're a daughter of a priest, you can't do this. Now, is Judah a priest? I don't think he's portrayed as a priest. But, you know, readers take this and get all kinds of, you know, interpretations and behaviors and those kinds of things. In this text, he's saying this. Now, are the authors of Genesis 38, are they aware of the priestly narrative? Did the priestly narrative of Leviticus come later? These are discussions that scholars have. I certainly don't know. I have an opinion, but I don't know. So they bring her forth, and Judah's all righteously indignant and fired up, and he's like, you've got to pay for this. What have you done? And when she was brought forth, and she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child? So she shows the signet and the staff, the bracelets and the things that are essentially Judah's. It'd be like in modern reading, if he gave his driver's license, right? And here's the guy who is the father of the child is the man whose driver's license this is. Bam. And she throws it down. And verse 26 shows that Judah's repentant. He acknowledges them, and she has been more righteous than I. So this is him speaking. So he essentially says, okay, you're right. Tamar, my bad. And it's because I gave her not to Shelah, my son. So the third son that Judah has, and he's like, I should have given you my son. And you're exercising your rights to be provided for and to be protected. And it says he knew her again no more. And so the author really wants you to know that they don't have carnal relations ever again, but she does have a child. In fact, verse 27 says that she has two children. There were twins in her womb. And this is reminiscent of Jacob and Esau. Look what it says in verse 28. It came to pass when she travailed that one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this one came out first. And it came to pass as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, how hast thou broken forth this breach? Shall be upon thee, therefore his name shall be called Phares. And afterward came out the brother that had the scarlet thread, and his name was Zerah. So twins come out, and this is going to be the continuation of the line of Judah. And there's a lot happening here. And I just want to say that at first reading, you know, we were horrified. We're like, this is a father-in-law sleeping with his daughter-in-law. Very tragic. And yet at the same time, I think there's other ways to read it. This story kind of reminds me of the story of Genesis 19, if you remember that, with the Moabites and Ruth and Jesus and the house of David. And one of the reasons why is because this lineage from Judah, actually this actual relationship, is the direct ancestors of David. And the author of Matthew is putting this in the narrative, specifically in chapter 1 of the genealogical line of Jesus Christ. So go to Matthew 1 and look at verse 1. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. And Jacob begat Judas, or Judah, and his brethren. So once again, that connection between Judah and Judas. And Judas, or Judah, begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar. That verse, verse 3 of Matthew 1, is directly linking into the story we just read in Genesis 38. And it says that Phares begat Esram, and Esram begat Aram, and Aram begat Amminadab, and so forth until you get to Boaz, and then Obed, and then Jesse, and then David. And so this is a story right here of the lineage of Jesus Christ. And in his lineage is this awful story of Genesis 38. So once again, Genesis is doing it again, and it's saying, you are not your past. You are not your ancestors. And also, out of ashes can come beauty. This is Isaiah 61. I will give you beauty for ashes, right? The garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. And so as bad as this story is, beautiful things come out of it. We get the lineage of Jesus Christ. Now, another reason why I like this story, and I know this is going to sound kind of clunky, but here it is. Verses 12 through 19 is totally a woman owning the situation. Here's a woman that's destitute. She has nothing. And she says, well, if you're going to turn the tables on me and you're going to make it so I just have to be destitute and walk around in the garments of widowhood and be poor, I'll show you who's boss. And so she literally and figuratively takes the bull by the horns of life, and she flips the world on its lid and says, I'm the captain. I'm going to be in charge. And personally, I kind of like that. I know that from a modern reader's perspective, people could say, well, this is just so horrible. But if you take the action of adultery out of it, if you just take that action out and just say, this is a story of Tamar just taking charge, it's kind of cool. So I kind of like her as a strong woman, even though, like I said, I wouldn't recommend literally applying the scriptures in your life in this circumstance of Genesis 38. But as a principle of being an individual who acts and is not acted upon, right? Second Nephi 2:26, right? That men should act and not be acted upon. I just love that phrase. This is a story of a woman who was acting. So I really like it. I know it's clunky. I know this is kind of tough, but there it is. So Genesis 38. I also think Genesis 38 was put in the narrative of Genesis right where it was, right between 37 and 39, to show you in stark reality a foil between Judah and Joseph. You see, in 38, Judah's in this circumstance where his wife's not on the earth, he's all alone, and he thinks no one's looking, and he goes and he acts in this way. And Genesis 39 is a similar story where Joseph is all alone, and he acts in a different way. So now we're in the 39th chapter of Genesis, and this is Joseph, and he's in Egypt. And it says that he's brought down to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. And the Lord was with him in chapter 39, verse 2, and he was prosperous. And so the master saw that the Lord was with him, and so he prospered him, and he made him the overseer of his house. That's Genesis 39, verse 4. And then it kind of goes down through a process of time that after these things happened, that the master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. That's Genesis 39, verse 7. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he has into my hand. And there is none greater in this house than I, neither has he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And so Joseph's take on this is, I just can't do this because I don't want to sin against God. Now, granted, he also doesn't want to sin against Potiphar. This man holds his life in his hands, but he certainly doesn't want to sin against God. And then it says in verse 10 that she came day by day, and he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And so as this, and most of you guys know this story, right? We've seen the musical, or we've at least read the scriptures or heard it. But over time, she grabs his garment and says, lie with me. And he pieces out, he takes off, and she holds on to his garment. It says in verse 13, it came to pass that she saw that he had left his garment in her hand when she was and was fled forth. And she called unto the men of the house, and she says, this Hebrew is mocking us. He came to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And so that's the story of Joseph, where he just gets out of there. Now, I think this is just my take on this. I think Potiphar knows the kind of wife he has. I think he could have killed Joseph, but he doesn't. He has to save face, right? He has to save face in his household and in front of his wife. But at the same time, I think he knows that his wife is up to no good. So what does he do? He puts Joseph in prison. It says in verse 20, Joseph's master took him and put him in prison. And the Lord is going to be with Joseph even in prison. So now, this is also an idea of catabasis. Catabasis is this idea of going down the staircase. Joseph starts out as a most favored son with this coat. And by the way, the coat probably wasn't a coat of many colors, as we've talked about. I do want to read this quote by Hugh Nibley. He said, there is no mention in any ancient source of a garment of many colors. That's an invention of modern editors trying to explain what's going on. But here it was, the garment that he gave him. It was the garment of the priesthood, says Hugh Nibley. No wonder they were jealous of him, they being the elder brothers, and he the younger in the patriarchal line coming down from Abraham. The garment had belonged to Abraham and had came down to Joseph instead of to the other brother. And so that's Hugh Nibley. So we have this son who gets this garment from his father, and then he just goes down, down, down. He goes down into Mitzrayim, into Egypt, this land underwater, as it were. He goes down to Egypt, and then he goes down to become a slave, and then he's sold by the master down into the dungeon, down into the pit of the prison. And so this is catabasis, going, 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 down, down, down. And then Joseph's going to anabasis, rise, 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 up to the top. And that is going to be our subject in the next podcast, as we cover Joseph coming out of the pit, rising all the way to the top from Genesis 39, basically verse 20, to the end of Genesis. And this is also the story of Jesus. Jesus is doing the catabasis staircase. He's coming down from the heavens where he was right next to the Father, all the way down into the pit of Sheol, into the literal pit with his body put under the ground. And then he will rise all the way to the top at the right hand of the Father. And so once again, Joseph literally is a perfect type of Jesus. And with that, we will end this podcast. I thank you for listening, and hopefully this has made some sense. And we've tried to kind of unpack some of these chapters as we've gone from Genesis 35 to Genesis 39. And we will see you next week.